I always feel like there's so much we can talk about, so much ground to cover, so I know we're breaking it up. But I kind of want to, if you don't mind, return to your early work in D.C. with St. Augustine's. And I'm wondering if you can kind of just lay out what the pressing issues facing the community surrounding St. Augustine's were at that time, which I guess was around 86, 87, 88. You know, what were kind of the most pressing issues, neighborhood issues that you found yourself tackling, you know, as part of the St. Augustine work?
Yeah. So it's interesting that you are taking me back to the mid-80s, because you know how the former New York City Mayor Giuliani talks about and brags about he saved more black lives than most black people. But one of the things that frustrates people like me, that for all our lives, our churches, our community centers, our parents and uncles and aunts and other relatives have been critiquing not only the violence that are in our communities, right, but the social structures that create the violence, you know, in this capitalist system. So one of the pressing issues at that time was that black churches, and I worked for one at the time, we were going around collecting guns from people, right? And I had to remind somebody about that who never heard me talk about that. You know, I said there were so many things that we were doing that people ignored because it was black people doing it, and then the colonized space wasn't being colonized at that point, right? Yeah. And so those things were insignificant to people, right? Mm-hmm. So it was a huge thing, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I know somewhere in my archives, I probably had the sheets of paper when I went out and talked to the folks, or the fires that we created, you know. So that's one issue. The other interesting issue is this whole movement in the country right now around racial equity and public health. So at that time, there still were hundreds of people at the corner of 14th and V, where St. Augustine was located, and 14th and W. And so what I used to remind people, when I saw those folks, I didn't have sympathy, because I don't have sympathy for people, but at a deep level of empathy, because when I saw those hundreds of people dealing with their addiction, it was always a public health issue to me. It was always people self-medicating, and you sort of don't really realize that you think of it that way. You just know everybody you grew up with is drinking a lot or taking drugs. And then in D.C. at the time, it was a manifestation of this tragedy in a public arena. That's all it was. It was just private stuff being dramatized in public. And so it brought a lot of fear for a lot of people. But to me, it brought a lot of concern and compassion, you know, because actually I knew the children of a lot of those people, you know what I mean? And knew that people were really struggling. So that was a huge thing, right? That now we're talking about it, what, almost 30 years later, as a public health issue, when it was a public health issue there, because those people couldn't get treatment. They were, like I told people, where were the prevention programs, you know? So it's a huge thing. The other thing that was happening, that H Street signifies right now, is that a block away at 14th and U were all these small black businesses who were saying that they're going to get removed, right? So if you and I walked up there now, you can see that that crisis was real, even though the Reeves Center weren't there at 14th and U, right? Those condos weren't there, but those people that lived there, they knew what was coming, right? Because they didn't control their leases, they didn't own their commercial real estate. Mm-hmm. You know, property. And so those were the three big things to me, right? Was the public safety issue that people were dealing with, the public health issue that was prevalent, and then the community space, you know, and retail space that people control through their commerce, but they didn't control the land, right? And so that's why now, you know, 1DC and our organizing approach is community control of land, right? Because mm-hmm. maybe some of those people would still be there, mm-hmm. you know, if they wanted to and if they controlled the land.
So who were some of the businesses and business owners around that corner, 14th
Avenue,
at that time? That
so Ben was still there, and Ben is still there, but it was a place called Wings and Things. I think if you look up, then it was... the deli, there was a deli at 14th and Wallet Place. I used to remember that guy's name anytime I talked about the deli, because I used to go in it like every day. Mm-hmm. I still could see its face. And then it was Duke's Shoe Shine. So Duke actually was moved from 11th and you over to 14th and you, you know. And I've known Duke for years, you know. Mm-hmm. And so there were some other places. And so there was another corner store. I can't remember that owner, you know. And then Lee's Flower Shop, which is still there. Mm-hmm. But there were dozens of small stores. In fact, I think one of the interesting things, I haven't done this, but I think you can do this. One of the interesting things that we might want to do is get Google Maps and historic sites. I think you can actually, two things. I know you can sometimes find pictures of these places, which would be interesting, or sometimes you can find leases, like in the recorder of deeds. Like, even though somebody owned it, you know, if you want to see who was leasing the place, you'll see the names of those folks. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In fact, there's a guy that I might have mentioned him to you, and I think I got his number. You should talk to, because he and I actually know I got some of the documents, right? But these documents actually aren't owned by Man of CDC or one. These are my documents. There was a group called the 14th and U Street Coalition.
I was going to ask you about
that. That's right. And Stanley Mays, who is still alive, he knew all those people because he still lives at 14th and Wallet. Hmm. So he and I were two or three of the only people that are still around, you know. Hmm. You should get us together one day, because I'm actually the secretary, so I kept everything. Hmm. I'm the secretary. I used to write the notes and, yeah. Those I'm gonna find those things. Those papers are dangerous. They're actually in a basement somewhere. Hmm. Whereas I wasn't thinking at the time, but the one busy stuff, I didn't put them in any basement. Like in a hallway in a box. Because when you put stuff in a basement, you know, it gets damaged.
Yeah,
I'm gonna go find that stuff.
So, were you there for the founding of the 14th and U Coalition?
No, I came It might have been found like in 79. So I came almost like, 6-7 years later. Mm-hmm. I came in the second iteration, right? Mm-hmm. So when it was founded, I can name these people: Losey York, Pauline Jones, Rosa Jeter. Damn, I'm getting old, but I forgot to remember. Then Stanley Mays. What was Kenner? Brian Kenner. Was Nicholas, this West Indian guy named Nicholas. He actually owned a little shop too, Nicholas. Hmm. Byron Nicholas was his name. All those people were in the first group of leaders, right? Hmm. And then it went down a little bit. And then I showed up, you know, in my early 20s, about 24, I think. Yeah, 24. And then this guy named Jim Henderson, who was a guy that studied law. He's a good writer, a really good thinker. And he was a member of St. Augustine Church. They had hired him part-time. Hmm. And then the church told me to work with him. And then Ernest Withers, who was a big guy in the Free South Africa Movement in D.C., and he's the son of Ernest Withers Jr., you know, I got stuff on Ernest, too. Ernest was the one that told me to save everything. Hmm. I wonder where Ernest stuff is, because he literally would come to me and get everything every week that I did and put it somewhere. Huh. You know, and I started to keep stuff, you know. Huh. And so we were a part with this guy named Darrell Wiggins, the renaissance of the 14th, and you coalition getting stronger, and then building Gino Baroni, and then organizing the businesses, you know. and then trying to stop the Thompson Dairy development that ended up taking place with this guy named Jeff Cohen, who was on the Lincoln Theaters Development Board as a little nicety to the community while he was trying to take the public land. So his deal fell through, and then eventually, almost like 10 to 12 years later, Donatelli and Klein built this new development. So if you go to like 13th and B, you'll see these townhouses called Harrison Square. And I'm really alert today. Thank you. That's so much on my mind. But yeah, so I remember the Thompson Dairy building, see? And I should have been taking pictures then, right? Mm. All of that. But you can find those pictures. Mm. So literally, we might just walk around, I can poke out stuff. Mm. You know what I mean? Yeah.
I mean, for people that are newly arrived in D.C. or yes. have been in D.C. for 10 or even 15 years, I think they would be surprised to know that these were issues and struggles that were of the 80s, of the 70s. And so I'm just curious to hear what the conversation was like at that time about 14th and U, because this was before the Metro was built.
Right.
This was before the Reeves Center. This was before, I mean, those major projects. And so I'm wondering what the concerns were at that time.
Yeah, I can actually make the concerns even crystal clear for you, starting with a person like Rosa York. And I can dramatize it by talking about this building called the Roosevelt Hotel, which is at, 16th and B, right? So that's actually the first building. And the first time as an adult, I was part of a direct action. So what happened was, because I was on staff, Rosie had come and got me and took me over to the building and knocked on doors of these seniors because the owner was trying to sell the building from under them. So you imagine it, like, this is like 1988, this is going on. So we actually go down to the city council with some people from this group called Project Wish, which was helping us organize. And that was the first time I actually stayed up almost all night, because we actually went down there in the middle of the day and we left like 1 or 2 in the morning after she saw the mayor. And she stopped them from selling the building. So can you imagine the effort it takes? Because now the building is sold and it's called like the Camden, you know, hotel condominiums on that same corner, right? So we take a picture or go to Google Maps and get the old picture and see this beautiful building where all these working class black people lived. There was a dentist there, there was a pharmacy, there was a doctor's office, all affordable. And then now see this new building, right? And so Stanley was one of the first persons that council members used to get mad about, because he would always say, well, this is going to become Foggy Bottom in Georgetown. People knew it, you know what I mean? And what's tragic is that a group that Slavery Gustin helped initiate, Project Wish, had a game plan where they wanted to build co-ops throughout D.C., and they didn't build enough political power to do enough co-ops. But I'm telling you, I remind people that there's people like me that are alive that know that this whole city could have been for everybody, right? And the reason why this city isn't for everybody is because it's not just urban planners or architects or developers. It's like churches gave consent, the middle class population gave consent, and definitely the government gave consent, right? And so now we have a city where almost only rich people can live in. You know what I mean? And especially public property and public land is always seen as a commodity for somebody else to exploit, rather than the people that live here. So those things were coming up, because as I told you, so Thompson Dairy was public land, the Children's Hospital was public land, the Reeves space is public land, you know, and they just sold that, right? You know, in exchange for the soccer stadium. You see, that's what I'm saying. So this is the same neoliberal economic game is being played, and you still have all this inequity in D.C., right? You know?
Yeah. Was there a turn? Do you remember there being a turning point for that area?
And it's always with development. These three developments, to me, were the permanent turning point where, unless we were going to take over the city and liberate the city, which means take over land, public land, or publicly subsidized land, then we couldn't stop it, right? This is what I've learned. The first was the Reeves Center being built. The second was the Greenmount Metro being started and completed. And then the third was Harrison Square. But let me go to the Metro for a minute. See, the reason why the Metro was important, because Metro development, the beginning, like I said, and then the end, was critical because that was the barrier under which a lot of the small black businesses were destroyed, because during that construction, there was no remedy, right? You know, so there was no reparations for all the damages, or what in legal terms they call liquidated damages for the harm that was caused, right? So you actually can put in Greenmount Metro, you know, 1990s or whatever, and you'll see all these tracks and stuff where people couldn't even walk for years, you know what I mean, right? And so that's why I use H Street as a comparison, right? So when you see H Street, you know, it didn't have the Metro, but it had neglect, right? And so now the new business over there can get signage and get subsidies, but the people that were there for 30 or 40 years, just like U Street, in fact, there were more businesses owned by local people on H Street, right? So then you have the end of the Metro. So then when the Metro was finally done and completed, at the end of the day, what, all the vacant land pricing is skyrocket. You know, all of a sudden you're using inclusionary zoning, which we think is a horrible law, because you can get two or three units that they call affordable, and those affordable units are 80 to 100% of the area median income, which means that they might cost you $200,000 to $300,000 to buy not even a one bedroom, like an efficiency, you see. Mm-hmm. And so all this is designed and planned, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I think that what's going to surprise people is there's a growing groundswell of resistance, because different cultures and classes of people realize that the target might have been to remove the chocolate from the city, right? And make it, like Derek Ira calls, a swirl, right? But what the people that are part of the swirl, or the South Asian people, the white people, or immigrant folks, they realize that all of us are going to be gone if we don't unite. So I think people will be surprised. I think in the next decade, starting with what they see, there's going to be a strong push, you know, to take back some of this plan, and to start questioning, you know, like the Wizards facility in Southeast, the Mystics facilities, and the soccer stadium, you know what I mean? And people will see some drastic action, you know? Mm-hmm. So
you mentioned the Metro. You mentioned the Reeves Center.
Yes.
And also Harrison Square.
Yeah.
Could you describe what you witnessed with the Reeves Center and Harrison Square as well? In terms of, I mean, because you were there during that period.
Yeah.
You saw
right
it transpire.
So here's where the controversy comes in with a government supported office building in an area where there's a lot of vacant land. And there's real affordable housing. Is if the government doesn't take a stand and support its citizens when it builds a building, when it bring good government jobs, right? And then it completes the building, but then it doesn't have a plan to stabilize the vacant land and the public housing for the current residents, right, with more support. Then what that change does is precipitate what a 1DC member, he's actually on tape saying this, Michael Pazer, said it was like a tsunami, right? So the Reef Center is the beginning of the tsunami, right? And then a next wave after, if you can imagine this, so the one wave is the Reef Center, right? And then the next wave is even bigger than the tsunami, because all of a sudden you had these rich young white developers from Donatelli and Klein coming in and getting public land and a public subsidy to build market rate townhouses two blocks from the Metro and Shaw, Harrison Square, right? And those things in the 90s were costing $200,000 or $300,000, right? So now that's why people think they get the deal. Somebody told me on Monday, friend of theirs got a good deal in D.C., and I think it was Sharp, where the house was for sale for $800,000, and they got it for $400,000. And I said, that person is just foolish. I said, wait till they find out what's coming, right? You know, all that's going to disappear, you know? And so that's what we see, right? Is the exaggeration of wealth, exaggeration of capital, and the exaggeration of land, and it really hurts people because, you know, I don't think most of us don't know anybody that can finance a $400,000 mortgage, right? You know, and especially not an $800,000 mortgage. So these are the things that are happening, right? And so what some of our white members who are, some are working class, some are doing well, even notice is that there's no way that white people can even notice that this is targeted for them, you know? Whether you're rich or poor, right? It's the complexion, right? It's the ethnicity or the appearance that they're looking at, right? Because they're not building for people who look any other way that can afford something that costs like $50,000 or $60,000, right? You know what I mean? Because of the people they're trying to get out of the city, you see, so, yeah.
And who was pushing back, if there were people pushing back against those projects, Reeves Center, Harris Square.
So I think the biggest group, I would say, it might be three groups. The first group was the 14th and U Street Coalition. Then Project Wish was pushing back really strong. And then here's a group that actually waned out, but was really strong when I got here, was the downtown cluster of churches. But they had a broader name. It was like something like the downtown cluster of churches for housing and homelessness, and support of homelessness. They had a homelessness component to it, or preventing homelessness. And at one point, they used to be really radical too, you know. I think they dissipated. But those were the groups, right? Yeah, you know, and even more churches were involved too. You know, some of the black churches, you know.
And what was there, how do you, I'm just curious how you explain the story of Ben's, which, and Lee's, and I guess maybe Duke's. I mean, there are probably a few others on that corridor. Just a very, very few that remain from 30 years ago. You know, do you happen to know how they were able to stick it out?
So, and the good thing is that I knew all of them. So, I didn't know Rick Lee Jr. well. I knew his father better. And like I said, I knew Duke, and I actually know Kamal, the son of Virginia, really well. Because he used to provide food for a youth education program that we ran at St. Augustine. So, we used to bring food around. So, to start with the easier one, I would say Ben could survive because they knew the neighborhood, and then it became a tourist and city and national attraction. And then if food is simple and it's greasy and it's good, you can actually survive. I mean, it's a true recipe, right? I mean, they were trying to make their food healthier, you know, and they've done it, but they didn't want to overdo it, right? You know what I mean? And so, but here's what's interesting about Ben. It's a little learning moment. So, you know, Ben's was in the Reeves Center. Right, but they moved out of there. See, that's what I'm talking about, because that actually wasn't beneficial, because that was part of the new thing, right? So it's interesting that Ben didn't flourish in the Reeves Center with the government workers upstairs, but the original store on U Street, the storefront, is still there. And it's across from the Metro now, right? And it's a big tourist attraction, right? So that's why this whole thing about neighborhood connection, same thing with Leeds, right? I think Leeds survived because of the churches, the people in the neighborhood, and then it's flowers, right? Like, I'm a big, I used to buy all my plants from there. So if you see where I'm headed, I'm going to get to Duke in a minute. If you have basic human needs met, right, then people can support it, right? If you ignore those needs, right, like the cleaners, right? So now there's a couple cleaners on U Street, right? But nobody supported a black person that was doing the cleaners. See, that's what I'm saying. So the same thing with shoes, right? So Duke survived because he was on the corner of 11th and U, and everybody would be lined up there. And he did better in the Reed Center. Why? Because it was government workers who wanted their shoes clean, right? And then he was on that corner, you know? And like me, Duke never complained about all the people in recovery across the street. They were like, they are people, you know what I mean? You see? And so that's why those businesses developed. And so what I'm saying is there were other businesses that probably could have been nurtured and developed, right? But that wasn't in the plan, right? Cleaners, bookstore. Here's another interesting, where's the barbershop? It's not a barbershop over there, right? Isn't that interesting? You see, because you don't want that, right? Because who hang out at the barbershop? You see what I'm saying? Yeah. There's no hair braiding salon. You know? See, if you pay attention, you notice these things, like, why is that there? Well, they keep jacking up the rent, you can't get there. You see? So I think Anacostia is going to face that same challenge, you know what I mean? Yes, because there's a lot of basic needs that aren't being met that they're not going to finance until somebody else. You say, I got a bright idea, you know? So.
And I'm wondering if at that time, yeah, in the late 80s and maybe early 90s, the Ethiopian community,
yeah, we're coming in, yeah,
and what, how that played out, or at least from your perspective, what, how that played out?
Yeah, let me take you back, because I actually, one of the first buildings I organized in, I think I'm going to tell you this, was at 13th and Clifton, and it was all Ethiopians. Hmm, and in fact, I'm still tight with those Ethiopians, and they are the Ethiopians. I have a place with, in Gonda, where most of these Ethiopians are from, right? And so you go up 14th Street, heading north into Columbia Heights, then you make the right on Clifton. And at the time, what's interesting, that's when Clifton Terrace was so-called this notorious place, you know. And then this building, 1341 Clifton Street, it was just sold about 10 years ago, you know. So the owner was trying to kick the African immigrants out, and they contacted Project Wish. I actually wasn't the developer, but I was just helping them organize. And that was the first time I met a bunch of Ethiopians. And I always associated Ethiopians not with U Street yet, but with Columbia Heights, because they were in that part, right? But then what happened is, so I didn't hang out in Adams Morgan much. So those Ethiopians took me up to Adams Morgan's, and that's where I went to the Fasikas and a couple of, the Red Sea was big then, which is closed now. So then they started hanging out on U Street. And then Dukem's opened up. And when Dukem's opened up, that's when all the other Ethiopians, I knew almost all those Ethiopians, you know. And I always viewed it as a good thing. They never felt like separate from the community, you know, until the pressure came in when black folks were leaving. Then on 9th Street was the first time when someone wanted to name it Little Ethiopia. And then some black folks got a little unsettled, right? Because when you're being in friends upon, then all of a sudden you feel like, wait a minute, we've been here. Because 9th Street, to me, was always a black business corridor and Ethiopians, right? So I think that's how the tension begins to play itself out, right? So that was actually the first time, and that was late 1990s, when I heard black folks like talking about those Ethiopians, you know? Because if you walk up and down, you notice there's no tension between African Americans and African Ethiopians, Americans, yeah. So, but that was the growth, you know? Yeah.
And there was a project that you mentioned, the Gino Baroni House.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
What's the story behind that?
So that was the first and actually only development that the 14th and U Street Coalition did. So they actually, that was public land, right? And I was just coming to D.C., and the project was getting underway, and I was actually responsible for screening the people that went in there. So I knew all the people, you know what I mean? And it was really interesting because we would do site visits every day. And it had a 15-year covenant on there that was renewed. So that was one of the first project-based Section 8 developments in that corridor that made it affordable. Yeah.
And do you know what year it opened?
It must have opened in 89 or 90. I had papers on that too. Actually, I had the contract on that. Gino Baroni thing somewhere. Yeah.
And what had you heard about Gino Baroni?
Okay, so when I was working on the project, two things. I didn't know who Gino Baroni was, and I didn't know much about Project X, Section 8 and federal subsidy. But because I was responsible for making sure people had real affordable housing, so when they filled out the application and I saw the income, I had to figure out, well, look, they only make like $10,000 a year. How they going to live in there? And then they would show me the other papers, which was the Section 8 contract. So that's how I learned about Section 8 contracts, right? Mm-hmm. And then I said, by the way, who is this Gino Baroni guy? You know what I mean? And he actually met Gino once. I think it was at the opening. Uh-huh. And they told me, well, he's this Catholic priest who, you know, a social justice advocate, and he was a politician and all that from Ohio. Yeah, so it was interesting, yeah. Mm-hmm. But here's what was interesting about me. So remember, I was in my early 20s, and at the time, a lot of Afrocentrism, you know, especially Santa Costa. I didn't want to know the name Gino Baroni. I was like, why are these black folks? Because the white priest and then everybody else was black. I said, what are we doing naming the building after this white guy? And I grew up with Italians. He was Italian too. So I was like, Italians are cool with me, but yeah. So that was a funny thing.
Were there other possibilities for the name, or had it already been
Mandela. Actually, Ernest Withers wanted Mandela. Yeah. Yeah, that might be in some notes somewhere. I remember because that's why Ernest bonded with me, because he was like, yeah, you're making sense to me, right? And we didn't want to disrespect Gino because he helped pass the law to get the federal subsidy, you know, nationally. But we're like, yeah, because that's when Santa Costa started emerging in the Free South Africa movement. So they said, we should name it Mandela. And we got outvoted.
That was also at the time when Mandela was not the way people
see him now. Exactly. Right. They were like, we were crazy because he's communist, right? And, yeah.
And so could you break down for us what you learned about how Section 8 works?
Yes.
In terms of, so you were saying, you know.
Here's why I'm one of the few people. Yeah. I'm one of the few people, and our organization is one of the few organizations that still believe that housing as a human right can be practiced in the United States of America. And it's partly to do with why we're so anti-war, right? So if you think about it, you should go online one day and just type in United States war budget, if you can find it, right? It's hard to find this sometimes. And you'll see this huge number, right? You know, or like the first time somebody told me, which horrified me, that, you know, our country is dropping 1,000 bombs on Iraqis every day. So that's any Iraqi, right? We're made to believe that they drop them on soldiers, but they drop them on anybody, right? You know how much that costs. So when we say we don't have money for people, right? We have money for wars, we have money for political campaigns, we have money for intruding into other people's countries, right? And so that's important, because when I talk about what I learned about project-based Section 8 and subsidy, you have to start looking at Reagan all the way up to this present moment. And I might be a little behind, but what was shocking to me, see, I thought that I knew how much the budget was cut when it came to public subsidies and the social safety network, right? But apparently I should think, like, well, maybe it's just like 15%. I think the real number is almost like 50% of the housing budget nationwide has been cut. So imagine what that really means, right? That means that's billions of dollars, right? So when we say we don't have the money, what we're saying is, oh, we don't want to tell you this, but we're putting the money in the wars and the other things, right? But when that wasn't the case, right, and we were meeting people's needs, especially when they looked a certain way, there was always money, right, for worker relief programs, right? There was always money for housing and money for farmers, right? I mean, you look at this. And so that's where the Section 8 subsidy comes in. So here's how it works. No matter what your income is, in a just and healthy society, we should provide housing for you. So if you have no income, then you'll get this housing voucher certificate, which is a Section 8, because that's the name of the statute, and it will cover your income. So we're the owners, we get that money because you sign this form and the checks come straight to us, okay, from the government. If you only make $15,000 and your rent is $1,000, you just pay 30% of that. And then that voucher will have a number in there saying every month this amount of money goes to the owner. But the crazy thing about it, which the wealthy and powerful people figured out. Well, let's support Section 8 until we can rape the market, because you can get more money through Section 8 subsidy than the marketplace in some of these neighborhoods, right? Because Section 8 pays the fair market value. And in some places, it was creating the market, right? You see? And so that's why when you look into it, you understand that all this stuff is political, and that sometimes it's a scam, because now we say we don't have Section 8 because that's the way to keep people in the city. Before we had it, because nobody wanted to live here. And so in order to not just get $300 a month, which is all anybody could afford, which was the fair market value, if you got a subsidy that marked it up, you say, hey, I'll take those Section 8 vouchers, right? Because it's filling my pocket up. Yeah, so that's what's going on. And then with the pejorative language associated with working class people in public housing, that's how they were able to even tear down housing, right? Rather than saying it was the social conditions that we talked about, or the public health issues, right? Or the public safety issues that lead to these things, right? Mm-hmm. So we don't view public subsidy or Section 8 as a bad thing at all. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And in fact, I guarantee you, if they allowed a Section 8 for lawyers and doctors and architects in the city, you think those lawyer, doctors, and architects wouldn't take that Section 8 and pay 30% of their income, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's what I'm saying. People got to understand the context of all of that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it became really vicious when, in the late 1990s, and especially the early 2000s, especially the first three places were Shaw, Columbia, and Petworth, owners was doing something illegal, which is they wouldn't tell you, but if you call up, they would say, we don't take Section 8, that's illegal. You can't do that. But they knew they could get away with it because people didn't actually know that it was illegal. Or if they knew, they wouldn't follow up with it. Or say, what'd you say to me? Record them or write it down. Yeah. But they're still doing it in places. Yeah.
And so in that area, Gino Baroni became, and is still standing and still serves that role.
Yes.
Are there other similar housing that has played that role?
Yeah, there's a place it's called Fairclip. It's at 14th and Fairmont. Right. That's a positive Section 8. Mm. Yeah. And then all the down 7th Street, we still have some of those. Mm. You know what I mean? Mm. Yeah. Yeah. But we're losing them because when they expired.
Right. So is it 15 years? 30 years?
Yeah, sometimes they're 15 and then 30. D.C. was lucky because they had a lot of 30 years. So that's why it's becoming a crisis now. Mm. So it's like 76 buildings that are going to lose their public subsidy like in the next 36 months. And one of our members is working on that for this legal group, and it looks like it could be up to 10,000 to 15,000 people. You know what I mean? We look at all the buildings and the families, you know. Right. So one way to look at it is this, right? Let me do this math real quick. So when you think about Barry Farms, which is what they told me is 434, I think, right? And what do you think the average family has three children, right? Which is not real generous, right? That's 1,300 people right there. So if you have 76 buildings, if you got some big buildings in there, see what happens, that's how it happens. So that's why we try to describe to people, displacement is psychological, it's physical, it's spiritual and mental, because it's gradually wears on you, right? So like, we were out at Berry Farm 10 years ago, and nobody was removed. 5 years ago, we heard about, because some of our members removed about 50 people. Now there's only like 200 people left in there. They said last week we had a meeting over there with Empower DC, and they said that there are about 230 people over there. It was 434, you see. Mm-hmm. You don't see no stories about that. Mm-hmm. They just beating the people down, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Why? Anacostia River, you know, Anacostia Park, you know, the new 11th Street Bridge, Anacostia Metro.
Yeah, I'm curious. I'm curious what how you see the future there. Particularly, I mean, there's the LISC commitment of $50 million. how you see, kind of how you are seeing that play out?
Yeah. Here, that'd be a great question to ask me in the fall, too. Hmm. Especially after 1DC comes off our retreat this weekend. Here's what the real plan is. if they could have Anacostia turn out like Georgetown and Shaw, then that's what's going to happen. And I think that's the plan. Our goal is to prevent that, right? Our goal is to have a healthy, equitable community where people control their labor, where people own their shops, where there's a human scale economy, right? And that we can eradicate poverty by dealing with, you know, structural racism and, you know, an equitable capitalist system, right, that puts money before people, right? So people got to remember this. We're not romanticizing it, right? Because there have been times, especially in smaller black communities or immigrant communities, whether they were European or African communities or Latinos, where people did have their needs met, right? You know, it's never been a big thing in this country. That's the myth that Donald Trump wants you to believe in, to make America great. I'm like, what country are you talking about? There have been small places, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like in New York, has some places, Baltimore has a place, and even D.C., right? There's some places where like my mother grew up, they didn't lock their doors, you know, people own corner stores. That's not the romanticized. It was a real thing in a small, concentrated area, right? Mm-hmm. So we feel the destruction because we're always under siege, right? And so that's what I'm saying. Anacostia is under siege, and if you look at everything about development, they don't talk about the people here. You can't talk about the people who live there without dealing with the real historical fact of what they lived under, right? And even help them become aware that the odds are against you, you know, no matter how many degrees you have, right? Mm-hmm. You know? Let's make it real. We have about 6 degrees or more, maybe, among the three of us. Maybe more, I think. Who has a better chance of starting a business in Anacostia? The three of us, without knowledge, and pool our resources, or somebody that just came here from, you know, Plains, Georgia, or Cincinnati, Ohio, you know, who don't look like us, right? It's true. Even the white members, there's white members who told us that they were shocked at how many white people are getting what is called HPAT to buy homes, right? When that program was designed for very low-income people, now they open it up to everybody, right? Why? Because who? If you open up to everybody, who's going to get to the finish line quick, right? People with more resources. While we still work on our credit or something, you know? It's a rough game. So the question is whether Trayvon White, who's going to be seated in Ward A, and Michael White, who's at large, and I heard Alyssa Silverman wants to know about land trust and whether they're going to come up with an alternate plan. I think D.C. is going to be surprised. I don't think it's going to go as easily as it did other parts of D.C. If some of these people stay around, there's going to be a lot more resistance. You know? Yeah. Because people see it, they say, this is the last frontier. And you know what's crazy about the last frontier? It's the most beautiful part of D.C. too. More water, more green, more hills, you know. We took some members over there. I remember when they were going to see some of the interns, and they were like, now we see why they want to take this. They went to Morris Road. They went up, you know, to Morris Road. They said, yeah. They said, I was surprised they didn't try to take it earlier. You know, so, well, they already took it once from the Acosta people, indigenous, you know, the real Anacostians. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right? You know. But let me tell you how vicious this is. I can wrap up here. You should look up this group called the DuPont Historic Trust. They just bought homes in Anacostia, and somehow the homes they bought were inhabited by two white folks who both are new to D.C. And the crazy thing is this, the three crazy things, not that they bought the homes and white folks live in them, right? Because we know that's what people want, but that they bought the properties somehow, quickly, right, that they renovated them at a loss of $100,000 a piece, and they're willing to take the loss. Why? Because they want to preserve the buildings, not the people in Anacostia. Those are three outrageous things, right? Unbelievable to me. And the Washington Post wrote about that, though. They're not writing about Berry Farms. Yeah, so look it up. It's called... Somebody sent it to me, and I read it. I was, like, stunned. You should notice. I said, actually, I didn't know that. Yeah, in Old Town Anacostia. And they said, and they plan on raising money. They plan on raising money to buy more of those homes. But I said, well, why didn't they sell them to people that live there? Right? At a loss. Can you imagine some black folks doing that? They'd be like, you're incompetent. You know what I mean? You don't know how to develop. You're wasting money. Read it. It's a real, you should, we should put it in the archive. It's a real article. Right? Yeah. Yeah. That's why I got to teach one day about this, right? Because that's what they were saying about us. They're like, Samir doesn't know how to run a development project. These people know that they were going to lose the money, you know? Then you imagine if they sold it to black people. They're like, you give them what? There's no line in there saying that they gave all that equity to those black folks. No line in there, right? Yeah. Okay, excuse me. Yeah.